Welcome to Get a Move On, the podcast for movement lovers who are fed up with their injuries and want to enhance their all-round health. On this podcast, I'll help you change how you think about pain and illness so you can drop the frustration and move freely. I'm Amy, an osteopath turned yoga teacher and mindset coach. On this pod, I'll be talking about the joys of pain, injury and illness, the mind-body connection, and how they relate to our movement practice so you can get a move on.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Get a Move On with Amy Slevin. My name is Jamie Slevin, and as always, I'm helping to co-host the podcast. Amy, how's it?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm pretty blonde.
Can we just talk about your hair for a second?
We can talk about the hair.
So if you can't see Jamie, he's gone from pretty much like almost black hair to like blonde, bright platinum white blonde. And I'd like to say it's because of me.
Yeah. Ames definitely helps me with the confidence to do it. I think I look like posh Slim Shady.
Stroke Justin Bieber.
Yeah, like the way it's sitting is very Justin Bieber. I'm sure the video of these will be out somewhere, so everyone can take a look and make a comparison with whatever shit celebrity they prefer. But today we're not talking about my hair. We're talking about the importance of movement when recovering from chronic injury or acute injury. And the reason why that sounds slightly strange when I first said it or heard it is because I often think about movement as aggravating something, as being chronically in pain. And I wanted to know where that was wrong, because if it's important, that can't be exclusively the case.
Now, I think we kind of have touched on this before a little bit, but whatever, we can repeat ourselves. You know, my parents repeat themselves all the time, and we just have to shut up and deal with it. So that's what's happening. So basically, I wanted to talk about this for a few reasons. One of them is that I was working with someone the other day who had a back pain flare-up, and I was trying to encourage her to start moving, and she kind of didn't really want to. She just wanted to kind of stay seated in her chair. I didn't have very long with her, so I didn't have time to like fully explain the benefits to her of moving in that moment, right? So she was having a pain flare-up, and she just wanted to sit still. And I get it, right? So it's a really common thing that happens. Like, you have a pain flare up and all you want to do is like wrap yourself up in cotton wool and hide from the world and hope that the pain goes away, which it inevitably will. But her reluctance to move really kind of struck me. And I was like, yeah, I guess because I'm so used to working with people who are into moving, that here was this one person who just was kind of pretty resistant. And I was like, okay, cool, that's really interesting. And so I kind of managed to eventually persuade her to do a little bit of movement in her chair, and that was really cool. And she actually enjoyed that, right? So, you know, she kind of went from kind of feeling a bit glum and a bit like, oh, you know, today's a shit day, to kind of like, ah, oh, I'm having a kind of little groove in my chair. The fact that she didn't really want to move really kind of struck me for various reasons. So there's one that's like, she's kind of not doing herself any favors by not wanting to move. Even though in that moment, it's just like, oh God, no, it's the last thing that you want to do. But it's in many cases the best thing to do. There are lots of reasons to move, and we're going to go through some of them. The reasons are both physical and psychological, and they kind of feed into each other. So just on a very kind of basic physical level, exercise is just known to have an analgesic effect. So moving, exercise basically brings down pain.
Okay, that's super interesting as a specific principle itself. How come?
How come indeed? We're not entirely sure. It's just one of the mysteries of the universe kind of at the moment, but we kind of know that it does work, especially for things like back pain. And we know that walking is really effective for back pain, as an example.
Could it just be a matter of attention? So when you focus your attention on something else, and something invigorating, as exercise can definitely be, it just takes your mind off the pain itself.
Yes, it can, except a lot of the time when people do have pain, they're really focused on it. A lot of the time there's so much fear around moving, and so much fear like, oh shit, like if I kind of move in the wrong way, if I do too much, then I'm gonna have more pain. And the fear feeds into the pain, and then the pain feeds into the fear, and then you end up in this like cycle of fear, pain, fear, pain, fear, pain, fear, pain.
Yeah, and you end up becoming hyper aware during exercise because exercise feels risky. So you're going to end up feeling like, I could move, but am I not going to aggravate this thing? So then you're so focused on potentially aggravating the thing you kind of aggravate it, not really because you're aggravating it, but just because you're so hyper-focused on it. It's a thing where if you want to hear your heart beat weird, you can make it. If you just listen to your heart and look for wrong beats, you can find them. That's not because they're there or that you're causing them to be there, but the subjective experience is of finding wrong beats. And I guess that's the thing with movement and recovering from something acute or chronic, is you kind of have to sort out your relationship with it almost beforehand so you don't just make the movement a more painful thing than it is.
Indeed, which is why it's important to go in little baby steps, which I'm going to get into a bit later. So the benefits of moving are, we just know that it has an analgesic effect. We know that exercise helps to release endorphins. And what do we know about endorphins? They make you feel good. But it kind of depends. Like, there's a particular, I think, intensity of movement, or I don't know exactly when the endorphins kick in and how much exercise is required in order to generate those endorphins. I don't know about that. But we know that exercise helps reduce pain. And we also know that, like, when you stay still, so when you're in that moment of like, oh my God, I'm in so much pain, I can't move. And I've been there, right? So a few times in my life, I have had like excruciating back pain, like to the point where I can't sit, stand, lie down, walk, anything. Can't do anything. It's so fucking painful. Like, I can't even breathe. It's so sore. It's not like a thing that really affects my life, but like, it has happened to me in my life. So I know how unbearably painful back pain can be, right? And I know how completely debilitating it can be from firsthand experience. And I know that in those moments when you're like, oh God, you know, when you're in that state, when you do kind of gentle movements, it has a real kind of calming down effect on your nervous system. And it also is telling your brain that moving is safe. And when your brain knows that moving is safe, then it's less likely to need to generate a pain signal in order to keep you safe. So there's a bottom-up approach and also a top-down approach, which we'll get to in a sec.
Okay, and that ends up being interesting because it says something quite significant about the nature of pain, which is like, it's not just, as we tend to think of it, a physical thing that happens when two mechanical bits rub against each other the wrong way, but rather there's this like regulating, protective element, which basically means it's brain-induced, which basically means you can turn it off, presuming that you change how you think about it, which is a quite radical thought. But we know it's true because when people run marathons, we know that they get tired, or they'll perceive themselves subjectively to get tired right near the end, but their body won't be showing any significant sign of that. But if you tell people that you're running 10K, at 9K, the same happens. If you tell people they're running 6K, at 5K, it happens. Whereas if you tell someone they're running 10K and you stop them at 7 and say you're done, they never will have hit the same wall that they otherwise would have done had they been running 2 kilometers less. And pain, I guess, and the brain work the same way here.
Yeah, similar, very similar. It is a protective mechanism. It is designed to keep us safe. And when you do have an area that is already sensitive, and sensitive is a thing that happens whether or not you have actual damage, right? So in the times when I've had like unbearable back pain, I'm pretty sure that there was no actual damage to me. But that doesn't say that there's no actual damage in other people. Sometimes there really is. But we can still regulate and down-regulate that pain response through movement, through changing how we perceive the pain, changing how we feel about the pain.
Yeah, okay. So say I've got this like acute back pain and I'm sitting here going, no, trust me, the doctor said if you move, you're fucked. Like, you don't want to be moving, it's going to aggravate it. How does changing my relationship with the pain outweigh the doctor's words of advice?
That's a really good question. And I kind of want to just focus on part of what you just said there before I answer the full question. Because basically, there has been an example recently of this physiotherapist who has quite a big Instagram account who recently hurt his back doing a heavy deadlift. And he filmed himself doing the deadlift and everything was kind of going well. You can't see anything particularly go wrong other than when he just drops the weights and goes, ah, and like puts his hand on his back. Other than that, you wouldn't know that he'd hurt himself. Like, there wasn't anything like visible. He knows that early mobilization after an injury is really important. And he was in a lot of pain. Like, it was keeping him up at night. Like, he literally couldn't sleep for like, I don't know, 4 or 5 nights. And he was doing like gentle movements. He was doing a little bit of weightlifting still, like light weights. And he was under so much criticism and fire from other physios who follow him, saying, "You're such a bad example. How can you be saying these things?" And giving him a really hard time for not completely resting. And I think that's part of the problem, right? Like, so much of the education that professionals get says, tell people to rest for ages, which we know evidence tells us, like recent studies tells us that actually moving is one of the most effective ways of bringing down the pain and helping yourself to get better and aiding the healing and recovery process. And so he was getting crapped on left, right, and center from a lot of people who were saying, stop moving, stop moving. And he was like, I am not going to stop moving. And he documented his pain recovery over, I think we're now on like week 6-ish. And his pain changed over the time. It kind of became more like disky, like it was a potential disc herniation. And then when he said that, the physios went berserk. They were like, what are you doing? If it's a disc, how can you do this? How can you be demonstrating to people that, you know, that you can still move when you have a disc herniation? What the fuck, man? And then he was like, fuck all of you. I know from the evidence that in order to empower my patients, first of all, I need to set a good example of how I'm treating myself. I know not to panic. I know that I'm going to get better.
And just to clarify, the evidence is in on that.
Totally.
Okay, so the thing you just need to totally rest and that's the quickest way to recover is just wrong.
It's total bullshit.
Shit, but you know, in school, I remember in PE learning rice.
Oh yes, rest, eyes, compression, elevation. Now, to a degree, a lot of that is true. So thanks for bringing that up. So resting and like taking time away from a particular exercise and like not hammering it completely in the same way that you were doing before is you're kind of going to do that anyway. Like your body is going to just tell you a little bit, but it's very misleading, right? It can be really difficult to distinguish between the pain signal that says stop it and the noise, right?
Yeah, so effectively what you're saying is your brain is giving you pain signals that are at times over the top protective, and adhering to them actually doesn't speed up your recovery, it slows it down. And if you can just move gently through that, you end up actually speeding up the recovery, which is in total contrast to the education we get.
Very much so. And there's even a bit of controversy about ice. So, I mean, we can do a whole episode on that. There's like people who've done a lot of research because basically the ice is about regulating inflammation, okay? However, there's a whole new kind of school that says, actually, let's not do the ice because the inflammation is actually a useful and necessary vital part of the recovery process. So the inflammation is like chemicals coming in, white blood cells coming in to break down the damaged tissue, bring new blood and nutrients to repair whatever is broken. And when you do ice, you're interfering with that process.
Yeah, it's quite an obvious point in one way because, like, obviously it's inflamed for a reason. The inflammation is only there in a helpful capacity, but it just looks bad and we associate it with injury. But maybe it's like banning fire engines from fires because we associate fire engines with disaster. So let's bin off the fire engines and that will speed everything up.
Very nicely put. Yeah, exactly. We're basically kind of interfering with a natural physiological process when we do the ice. But that's not to say like it does have an analgesic effect, okay? Because the cold, the sensation of the cold is sent to your brain via different nerve fibers than the pain signal. They get there faster. And so when you do put something cold on a freshly injured area, it can just help to kind of bring a bit of like pain down. Not that pain is like such a bad thing, right? But that's another topic for another time.
To jump in, I remember just on this topic, I was really ill. Not really ill. I was in bed all week with flu, throwing up kind of ill. A couple of New Year's ago. And I was staying at my dad's house because he was away. And it was much nicer than my flat. And I remember, Amy, you were given the job of dropping off basically pain relief. Do you remember that?
I remember this.
And you were going away the next day or something. So you came in and I was thinking, oh, my wonderful sister bringing me my pain relief. And it was, don't come close to me. I'm going away tomorrow. Don't get me ill. Also, I'm going in 5 minutes. By the way, I didn't bring any pain relief because pain's not so bad.
I know. Don't you love me for that?
Yeah, just on the ice thing as well. Like, obviously, it's great for muscle recovery And that's why like you have ice bath straight away after doing high intensity exercise. Is that a separate point?
Sort of. Now, I'm not an expert on ice baths, but there is something about the fluid dynamics, and fluid dynamics is basically how fluids move around your body, right? So basically what happens is you get into the cold thing, or you put the cold thing on, and your blood vessels react to the temperature. So if it's cold, generally they will constrict, and then there is like a follow-up reaction where they get dilated, vasodilation, and that's kind of when you get the redness coming to your skin. And it just basically is about shifting the blood flow from certain parts of your body to other parts of your body. So obviously it's going to your skin a lot, or coming away from your skin into your muscles, or away from your muscles more into your skin. And that kind of circulatory thing apparently is quite recuperative. In terms of the physiology of, we've reached the extent of my knowledge, sorry.
That's super interesting, right? Because I know like there's a big thing about like Ronaldo being obsessed with ice baths. Like there was a story, because he's just moved back to England, so he's very much in the press. And The Athletic were doing a bunch of articles trying to understand the man. And Ray Clements, who's a English dude, but was one of the coaches at Real Madrid in Spain, basically told a story where they got back from a midweek European game. And they got back at like 3 or 4 a.m. because, you know, they were in Russia or something. And they had a training tomorrow. They didn't have a day off because they had a game in like 48 hours. So he said, can I have the keys? And he was like, what? Like, yeah, the keys to the training ground, because I'm going in for an ice bath at 4:30 in the morning. That was like non-negotiable. Like an ice bath happens after exercise to aid muscle recovery. It's interesting that that happens because of fluid dynamics. What happens if you move and your body's like, whoa, that's really painful? Do you kind of have to be able to work out what counts as okay pain and not okay pain?
Yeah, and that's really normal. So there is an occasion when I was helping one of Dad's friends who had done something to her back. Like her back was suddenly like in massive spasm. She could mostly just sit, but she couldn't move. And so Dad called me. He was like, Amy, it was like 10 o'clock on a Saturday night. Amy, can you come around and just help my friend, please? Because she's hurt her back. And I was like, okay, fine. So I get there and she's sitting in the chair. She like got her hands on the table and like breathing like anyway. And I'm like, okay, so let's just try these little very gentle movements. And I think actually the irony, right, or maybe it's not ironic, but like I think Dad was expecting me to just like rub her a little bit and do some osteopathy with her. And I was like, there is no way I'm doing that. First of all, I'm no longer an osteopath. And I think I did actually rub her back, to be fair. But the rubbing of the back does have a soothing effect. It's like when a kid falls over and like hurts its knee or whatever, the rubbing of the knee that the parent does has an analgesic effect. But also in terms of what this woman needed to do in her life, me just rubbing her wasn't really going to help her that much as she needed. So I started doing some movements with her and just super gentle, just like, just move your upper body around, just move your arms around. Very teeny, 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 tiny movements. And the reason for that, obviously, she wasn't capable of doing a big movement, but the teeny, tiny movements were basically sending messages to her brain, like moving is safe. And gradually over time, she was able to stand up. And the way that I did that was I was just like, okay, so just like push your hands into the table, slowly kind of lift your bum a tiny bit off the chair and lower yourself slowly back down again. And then we just did that, I don't know, as many times as was necessary until she was able to stand up. And then once she was standing, we started doing some other movements, like teeny tiny gentle movements.
Yeah, that's cool, because we're basically soothing the brain. You know, it's like with cats, they get hit and then you got to like approach really slowly. Otherwise they freak out. And eventually after like weeks, they kind of like let you come near. And eventually, like, you can stroke them and then eventually you can pick them up. But they require, like, the feedback, the training of, like, this isn't going to hurt. It's a bit like that.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the... I mean, what have you been doing to cats, basically, is my question. but, yeah, that's exactly it. But that's also, like, you know, she needed to get herself home. And in order to get herself home, she needed to walk down a flight of stairs, get into her car, get out of her car, and walk to her house into her bed. Like, if I had just given her a little rub, she probably would not have been able to do that. And that's not to belittle osteopathy, right? Let's just say I'm not belittling the powers and the magic of osteopathy. It is really effective. But in that situation, I knew that she needed to get up and do her thing.
A couple of weeks ago, it was yoga. Today it's osteopathy in the firing line.
Let's just bash everything.
Okay, cool. So is there a difference between then the movement required with acute injuries versus the movement required with chronic pain?
No, actually, the principle is basically the same for both. But I guess the difference is an acute injury is fresh, it's just happened. And so actually, what's really useful, if you, for example, sprain your ankle, or if you have a knee thing or a shoulder thing, just super gentle movement within the first day or two after you first injure yourself is really useful. So it can be just like, for example, like ankle sprains. One of my favorite, because I sprain my ankles many times, right? So this is my little protocol for when I sprain an ankle, and what I share with other people is like little circles with your foot. And you want to just do like a teeny tiny circular motion within the pain-free range. And that's the whole key to the whole thing, right? You want to keep everything within the pain-free range to begin with. And gradually, you probably don't necessarily notice as it's happening, but the pain-free range starts to increase and expand as you're moving, because the threat level is reduced. So your brain is then allowing more movement to happen at the particular joint that's a bit sore. Early mobilization is really useful. Also, like, just listen to the pain, right? Listen to the pain. It's going to guide you. A little bit of pain is fine. It doesn't mean that you're doing any more damage. Obviously, when it is like, you know, that's probably a little bit too much. So you can use the pain as a guide, but a little bit of pain is normal.
Yeah, it's an analogy for life. Like, you want to be kind of on the border of your comfort zone and your discomfort zone. And then the more you do that, the more the zone gets bigger, and eventually you can get your bum off the chair and drive yourself home.
Yes. And the same, I think, for chronic pain, but chronic pain is a bit different, because depending on how long you've had the pain, usually with chronic pain, it's not related to any particular physical injury per se, but there is still a lot of fear around moving. But we know that for chronic pain also, it's really important to be moving. And the psychological effects of that also are vast. So as I was kind of saying earlier about the pain, fear, pain thing, for chronic pain, it can be so tempting just to kind of back away from anything that might be a little bit scary and not do a lot of movement. But then you kind of end up limiting your life so much. So many people with chronic pain stop going to work. They stop interacting with their families in the same way. They just kind of like end up living this life that's incredibly limited, unnecessarily. And that's why the importance of moving. So you're first of all telling your brain that moving is safe, but you're also telling yourself that you're capable, and you're telling yourself it's okay for me to do these things. And that helps your self-esteem, and if it helps you to feel confident in yourself, which then when you feel a bit more confident in yourself, that reduces the pain a little bit. So it's all kind of linked. But the more you kind of back away from stuff and you shy away from stuff, the more scary doing anything becomes.
Yeah, you're sort of making your comfort zone smaller and smaller. But also, like, now your life is just dictated by the thing. Well, now your social life, your work life, your romantic life, your everything life is being dictated by the pain. Whereas if you can kind of keep on doing these things in the capacity you can do them comfortably, I guess, A, you expand the amount of things you can do comfortably, but also, like, as a percentage of your life, it's just taking up less space.
Exactly. Yeah. And also your tolerance. So when you are in that state of like major fear, major pain, your tolerance for certain stimuli is really, really low. So for example, like standing up from a chair, for example, for most people is not a painful activity. But if you have long-term back pain, for example, standing up from the chair might become a really scary thing to do. Getting out of bed might become really scary. And the more you shy away from doing those things, the more scary they become. And then you just end up in this, like, as you just said, like the state of kind of like nothingness almost.
Okay, so if there's a takeaway for people listening about how they should practically deal with chronic pain / acute injury and how movement should be part of their response, what would that takeaway be?
Go gently to begin with. Dip your toe in the water. See how it feels. There is a feedback thing. So if it feels like too scary, too overwhelming, use that as feedback. Okay, cool. So maybe just did too much. Maybe went too far. But also just like know that moving is going to help you. I think really actually is the takeaway. Like, know that moving is going to help you, even if that movement is teeny tiny and it feels like it's not going to do anything. It will. it is all going to have like a compounding effect over time. So just little by little, gradually, there's a thing called graded exposure, which is where you kind of like increase the dosage to the exercise or anything, like spiders even, as an example. You increase the load, the dosage, the speed, all sorts of stuff, gradually over time as your tolerance increases. But basically the evidence says move.
Cool. Ames, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
So everyone at home, thank you for listening to another episode of Get a Move On with Amy Slevin. And as always, we'll see you next week.